Thank you for joining us on this episode of Eminent Teachnology with Dr. Rochelle Newton and Drew Stennett, where we examine current and emerging technologies through the lens of diversity and equality.
So hello, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of Eminent Teachnology with Dr. Rochelle Newton and Drew Stennett. Today, we're going to talk about fun technology. A lot of times we have very deep conversations, and I'm sure this will also be a deep conversation, but we're going to try and, you know, a lot of times we use technology for very work-related things and business-related things, privacy, banking, all these sort of, I mean, I won't say they're not fun, but they're definitely not fun for me. Maybe work stuff is fun sometimes, but there's also a lot of great fun things to be done with technology, and so that's what we're going to talk about today. Rochelle, did you have any thoughts behind this topic? Rochelle suggested this excellent topic today, so I'm very excited for it.
Well, I was thinking that most of our conversations are pretty heavy, so I thought we'd do something that's fun. And I know I'm always warning people about the challenges of technology, so I thought we'd do something fun. And there's so many topics that we could talk about. So one of my favorites is the Internet of Things. It is not truly a fun technology, but in a way it is, right?
Oh, yeah.
So that you can tell your refrigerator you don't have any eggs and to order some eggs. Or you could tell Alexa to turn off the lights or all those kinds of wonderful things. You know, technology has a lot of benefits and we have come a long way. It continues to be a source of convenience for humans. It really does. Yeah. It's really, really amazing. You know, how many things, you know, think about this, how many times our grandparents or our parents wrote letters to their relatives to stay in touch. And now we can pick up the phone, we can FaceTime and we can text them. We can do all these things, conveniences, you know, so many conveniences. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those conveniences are meant to bring joy, to break up the monotony of what we do every single day, you know, to break it up. So like social media is one of those fun technologies, I guess, if you consider it fun. They've turned it into a networking opportunity than anything else, what social media has become.
An advertising target,
absolutely. And then they are, you know, lots of other little things. You know, they've got robots. So especially in Asian countries, they build these little robots to do things, to go get your beer or to go get the remote or something. So there are a lot of fun things. So there's so much to talk. But I know a little bit about you and your fun technologies. So I would like to talk about that. So what technologies do you consider fun in the truest sense of the way, i.e. they bring enjoyment or pleasure?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So there are a number of them. And it's funny because like growing up personally, like I've always been like a gadget person, like a new gadget. Like I love when who was the company that made that first like smart thermostat? Like thermostats are something that like I could care less about. Right. Like I want the house to be tempered like a comfortable temperature and that's it. And then when they released that like cool thermostat that like it would glow and you could like program it with your phone, it's just like, oh my God, that's like the most amazing thing I've ever seen. Don't care about thermostats, but definitely want one of those. The big one for me though, that we were talking about before we started recording is I really like these little Raspberry Pis, which are these little cheap circuit boards that you can get online for, I think it's $25. You get the circuit board, which contains the CPU, like a network connection. You still have to get a little power source for it or just use your phone plug-in and a little SD card. But for, you know, under $40 or $50, you get a tiny functional computer that you can do like whatever you want on. And like over the years, I've just sort of gained, we've probably got like two or three in the house now. And they're always fun just for like little projects. When we were, we went on vacation a few weeks ago, and while we were away, we weren't on our home Wi-Fi. And my wife and kid were like, why are all these like ads on our phones while we're not at the house? And I was like, oh yeah, like at the house, I block all ads. we don't get ads at the house. And we're able to do that because I put a little ad blocker on a tiny little Raspberry Pi and just run it on the network and it just kills all ads. And it's been amazing. And besides like the sort of tangible benefit of not having ads, I also really like just having something to play with. And it's something that I can, you know, put in my hands and plug into our network and, you know, I don't do much actual like programming on there, but it definitely runs a little Linux server. And actually, it's even on our or one of them is on our podcast cover is holding one of them. But it's just like a fun little toy. Like it's a tiny little computer. If it were to like, you know, totally die, no problem. We can order another one and, you know, 40, 50 bucks later, everything's great. Or, you know, it can just die and we don't even really need it anymore. But that's one of the fun technologies that I really like.
So tell me, what exactly is a Raspberry Pi?
So a Raspberry Pi, I believe they started as a way to give, and this sort of relates back to our inclusion talks, but they started as a way to give underprivileged communities, I think mostly out of the United States, a way to do computing. So they said, hey, computers are expensive, right? If you want a desktop computer from IBM or Dell or wherever, you're going to pay multiple hundreds of dollars, maybe not $600, but, you know, at least $400 or $500. But all of the pieces were getting so inexpensive. The company that makes the Raspberry Pis, they said, look, we're just going to figure out how to make these small things. We're going to make them as cheap as we can. They'll still be, you know, they'll have reliability, but they're not going to be, you know, a desktop computer. And by doing that, they were able to like just cut tons of costs and create this little, you know, it's the size of a deck of cards, if that, and make it, manufacture it, and enough hobbyists like myself bought them that they were able to keep it going. And then every year or every 2 year, they make them a little bit faster, give them a little bit more RAM, but they still keep that price around $35, $45. So that's always been really nice.
So why would anybody get one? Why would anybody want one? Okay, inside the United States, they're not, you know, in a country where the access to technology and the cost of technology is so prohibitive.
Mm-hmm. Why inside the United States or outside? Or
inside the United States.
So one reason would be if you just want a really cheap computer, you can get a cheap computer. The downside to that is you're going to have to do some work to get it actually working, right? Like if you wanted to use it as your desktop daily computer, that's going to take a lot of work. And I don't know that that would be the best thing. If you have a classroom of kids where you want to give them something that they can, you know, whack on all day and do miscellaneous things to, and then at the end, just delete them all and, you know, reformat them, I think that's a pretty good use case. So educational purposes, I would say. One thing that a lot of folks use these for that I'm not super familiar with is actually adding boards to the Raspberry Pis. Uh-huh. So they have, and this is going like beyond Drew technical knowledge, but if you're an electrical engineer and you want to create like a new gadget, like a new, let's say a new type of credit card reader or a new, you know, gas pump or something that you want to be able to control using a tiny little circuit board, you can do that with this as well, because they have the, what are they called? Like pinups or whatever. Like they have a little interface that you could physically solder more electronic pieces to for really cheap. And, you know, you think about before Raspberry Pis existed and before these computer parts got so cheap, if you wanted to build a device that you were going to make, you know, modular and plug other things into, that was expensive, right? Like that's probably more than a desktop computer. And now you can just order these tiny little boards online for, you know, less than the price of a video game and have something in your lab that you can just totally play with. Throw away, trash, buy new. People do clusters of them. I was just looking, I was reading a dude's Twitter account where he has he's building a rack for his Raspberry Pis. So he has like a little metal bar with a bunch of platforms for it that he can just plug them all in. And now he has like, you know, a cluster of pretty good computers for, you know, barely any money. They're very, I would call them more of like maybe a hobbyist thing. Like if you're into computers as a hobby, they're very, very fun to play with.
And is there a reason why you think that they have not been marketed aggressively in the United States to people who are in, and I guess maybe I think the answer might be is because there's a learning curve to get used mm-hmm. to using it and things like, but why do you think it's not marketed so well in the United States, and why has it been, been not necessarily something we promoted for communities that are marginalized or have socioeconomic issues?
That's a great question. So I think there are a couple of reasons. I believe it's a nonprofit, so they don't have great advertising and are, I would call them like actively bad with advertising. They just sort of let the community, you know, advertise it out. There's a big learning curve. And the other thing is a lot of schools and communities now use Chromebooks instead of something like a Raspberry Pi, right? Like a Chromebook, for those that aren't familiar, is a, it's a laptop. It's optimized to run web type services like web browsers. You know, it'll have like an email client, but the email client will be sort of wrapped in a web browser. And those are really cheap to make, and they are manufactured and marketed by Google, which has lots of money. So I think those have sort of overshadowed things like Raspberry Pis for schools and things like that. I know here with when kids have been, you know, stuck at home for school because of COVID and all that, you know, not every kid has a laptop. And in fact, like tons of kids don't have laptops. So the schools were providing little Raspberry Pis, or not, I'm sorry, not Raspberry Pis. They were providing Chromebooks to students as a way to stay online and stay connected and really like do their homework and even just participate in school in general.
Yeah.
But it's also not just school kids that use Chromebooks. Like a lot of business people use them. My wife uses a Chromebook as like her main laptop just because most of the stuff she does is going to be on a web page. So she does not need, you know, a $2,000 Mac OS computer.
Yeah.
And they just seem to work well. It's sort of nice to see technology come down in price and be made available to people instead of the opposite, which is, I mean, we're recording this podcast on a Mac OS box, but, you know, those things are just going up and up and up in price.
Absolutely, because of their convenience. But I do think the smartphone is one of those fun technologies for people that also is very expensive to have, but it's replacing that huge market. And that may be why phone manufacturers are able to charge so much for these phones now, because people, this is the only device that they have. They don't necessarily have all these other things, but that's a very important part. And I think you should talk more about this Raspberry Pi so people get a sense about that. Are there other things comparative to the Raspberry Pi or other kinds of tools like that out there?
So not for the price. Like the Raspberry Pi is so cheap. Like I don't know that anybody could make something cheaper and make a profit, because I don't think the Raspberry Pi people are actually making a profit. Intel makes something similar but much more expensive called a Nook, N-U-C.
Oh yes, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. And those are super nice. They're little tiny, tiny, tiny computers that have a ton of processing power, but they're not cheap. You're going they may be cheaper than a full desktop, but you're still going to pay a couple $100s for them, if not a little bit more.
Right.
And yes, they will be a little bit faster than a Raspberry Pi, but like for me, it would be hard to justify buying one of these little Nooks when I could get, you know, 5 Raspberry Pis for the same price and do mostly the same thing with them.
Yeah, well, that's it. Okay, so tell us your other fun technologies.
So another one, which I was like way late to the game on this, is e-readers. So like reading books and graphic novels on a tablet. I don't know if you know this, Rochelle, but I'm not much of a reader.
What?
It is true. It has been quite a while. I think it's been the last book I read was that Game of Thrones book that came out like 10 years ago. So it has been
quite a while. So you're reading on an e-reader?
Oh, yeah. 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 Now I do. And it's been great. Like, I really like having, you know, you can fit like a ton of books on there. Not lately, but for the past few years, I've been into graphic novels. And I don't mean like Superman comics. I mean like actual novels that have pictures, which I think there's a big difference. No superheroes, nothing wrong with superheroes, but it's just not like the thing that I like to read on my e-readers. And then I also like being able to, hey, I'm going to read a little bit of a book. I'm going to read a little bit of a graphic novel. And now I'm going to look at the internet, and it's all right there on a little tablet. Yeah. I think lots of people probably do that with their phones, but I just like having something that's a little bit bigger and more more like a book. Do you, use an e-reader?
You could do that on your iPad, you know, or on your Samsung tablet or whoever's tablet.
Oh, yeah. And that, actually, that's what I mean. Like, I do have, I think that the one I use now is, I think it's an Amazon Fire tablet, but it's not an e-reader as far as like using the, what do they call it? The e-ink,
Yes.
So the one I have is like an actual LCD screen, which I like it because I read these graphic novels, but the ones that have e-ink, which is, it pretty much makes your tablet look like a book, right? Like it's not backlit. It's just, it looks like a, you know, print on a page, which is very nice. Do you use e-readers, Rochelle, or do you read books?
So I am older than dirt. So I prefer a pencil and a book so I can annotate or write notes or remind myself what it is. I do have Audible from Amazon, and I think I have about 4,000 credits, but I don't read it that way. I prefer to have a printed book. I think you know this about me. So every book John Grisham ever wrote, mm-hmm. I have read. And I write myself notes so that if I ever get lonely or bored, I can go back and remember what I liked about this book and what I didn't like about this book. So
nice.
Not really, but I do have, like, so I have a Kindle, probably haven't connected to the internet in 5,000 years. It's probably been just thrown away. I think someone gave me a Fire tablet a couple of years ago. I don't know where it is either. But if I do read something online, so I was reading a legal thing, where they were talking about, and again, you know me, I was reading this thing about why killing Black and brown people is so easy to do. And there are two cases, Slaughterhouse and Cruikshank, were the two cases that the Supreme Court ruled in post a 14th Amendment that said it was okay to kill Black people, individual citizens, not the government, not the police, but citizens, you walking down the street, if you were to shoot and kill the Black person, you would not necessarily find any recourse for doing this. And these two cases are profound cases because the Supreme Court ruled in both cases that this was okay for a citizen to kill a Black person. Again, this is right after the 14th Amendment, between the Jim Crow and all that other stuff. Yeah. But they actually ruled that. So when you're reading something like that on a tablet, you know, because of how your brain and your eyes work together, you know, your brain has a tendency to skip over words, right? So you know, like you don't pick up the articles, you don't always catch the tense or whatever the verb was. So you're skimming almost as you're reading, even when you're reading a book. But when you're reading something this detailed, you are forced to read it. Sometimes I read it out loud just to make sure I heard what I read in my brain. So it, you know, no. So the answer to your question is no, I'm not a big fan of e-readers. I like to have the book in my hand.
I know that some, and you know, if you like having a book, and I also like the recent times I have read like books, it's usually like when we're on vacation and like, I don't want to drop my e-reader in the pool. Uh-huh. And like, that's where I like having something like in my hand. And I don't know, there is something about that. I'm probably a little bit too rough with books, but being able to like pick up a book and say like, oh, I can tell that I've read the first half of this book because those pages are wrinkled and there's like some of my sweats on there. Like it's sort of nice. And even, and maybe I shouldn't have said like, I haven't read a book in 10 years because I have read books within the last 10 years, but
he just doesn't mean a physical book. He's read a digital
book. Right. Well, even I was thinking back, I guess it was maybe like last summer when we were on vacation, my dad reads a ton of books and he's always given me books to borrow. And I took some that he had probably given me like 2 or 3 years before. And there was something really nice about like reading through a book and knowing that someone else has owned that book and like read through it as well. And like seeing where the like downturn pages has been, it's like, oh, like this is where my dad like took a break when he was reading it a few years ago. Like, I don't think that you can really replace something like that with an e-reader. I think you can take notes in them now.
Yes, you can. I think they've made it so it's easy to annotate. But I will tell you, even I don't bend the pages. I put, when I'm reading, I just put the leaf or the cover of the book between the pages I've read and the new page. And when I write on the book, you only know it if you read through the book where I've written. And I do this to my son a lot. I challenge him like this. So I'll give him a book. Mm-hmm. And like what do you think about such and such and such? And he goes, what is that? I'm like, go read the book. And so he'll pick up the book and he'll try to look for the page where I made the note.
Yeah. So how often do you find yourself going back in and reading your own notes?
All the time.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a big American history fan. I love American history. I love everything about it, the good, bad, and the ugly. So I love to read. And so these two lawsuits I was just telling you about, you know, it's interesting to see where Lincoln was in this process. You know, so we think of Lincoln as the great emancipator, but in reality, he was for states' rights. And early on in his presidency, his answer was to send Black people to another country. So, you know, maybe you go to Costa Rica or maybe you go somewhere else. He did not intend for Black people to stay in America. And it's not really clear whether he was empathetic to Black people or whether he was trying to correct a problem that would make the majority of the country happy. So, yeah. You know, when I started reading about these two lawsuits, I went back and read a lot of my Lincoln books because, I mean, I was really surprised to find that Lincoln wanted to send the Black people to Costa Rica.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
What?
I had never heard that before. I did not know that was a thing.
Right. So, you know, it's like, okay, let me go back and reread Lincoln because, you know, I've always known he sat on the fence. He was pro-states' rights. And then he became, I guess, aware of the injustices that were happening to formerly enslaved people at the time. And so it's just amazing to see the progression of a mind, right? So when you become enlightened or you learn something, to see that progression of the mind.
Yeah.
And so going back and rereading some of the Lincoln stuff or reading some of the Malcolm X or Martin Luther or Frederick Douglass, whoever it is, to go back and read that and get a sense of how their minds, you know, adjusted as they learned and became more aware of the issues that were around them. So I love to read. And so there is no greater gift for me than a book. And, you know, people, so because I've said that so much, people give me Barnes and Noble and Amazon gift cards all the time. I want somebody to go to the store and find a book for me to read. I want somebody to say, so our friend Vernon, mm-hmm. Vernon is an avid reader and he's an American history reader too. And so, he was reading something. I can't remember what he told me he was reading, but I sent him right as COVID hit, I sent him the Grant book, you know, Ulysses S. Grant. I sent him the Grant book and he absolutely loved it, you know. And, you know, it's like I kind of picked that out for him because of what I know he likes to read. Yeah. But I think those kinds of things are the things that really make reading exciting. And what you were saying about your father is really amazing too, because he's already read it. And you can imagine what it's done to his mind as he read the story, whatever it is that he read, you know, that he's learned or evolved from wherever he was in something before he was, you know, aware of all this that's in the book. So, you know, the fact that he's doing it to his son, and hopefully you'll pass that down to your son and it'll become a tradition. Maybe your son will become totally just a digital reader and not a book reader, but the fact that there's this history of reading and it's in your family, that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, it's very neat. One of my dad's, so he's retired now, but his one of his retirement projects is he's writing a book, and I will definitely send you this whenever he gets done, but he's writing a book about we come from Lynchburg, Virginia, which had after the Civil War, like a large population of the freed slaves went to Liberia. So he's writing a book. I guess it's like a nonfiction book about the letters that they were writing back and forth, which is sort of interesting. And that's like a piece of American history that I knew nothing about, you know, that's especially great. Coming from a town like that, it's like, oh, this is like part of our history. And like, we just don't know anything about it.
You should research the name of your town. Find out why I got that name.
So I've heard many different things. I'm not sure what's right, but I've heard that it is the brother of the person that actual lynching is named after, which is very like, not great, but also I guess not surprising for a Southern town. It's
especially for a Southern town that had as many formerly enslaved people, you know, to come to Lynchburg. You know, I watched Family Feud, Steve Harvey's Family Feud, I've watched all the Family Feuds, whoever was on it, I watched it. But he talks about West Virginia a lot, you know, and to see the diversity of West Virginia, you know, and, you know, it's history is hard. History really is hard. And I think that the reason why there are so many stories about Lynchburg is because we're trying to modify the history so it doesn't look as terrible as it does. You know, we don't ever want to come face to face with bad things or things that we are somehow linked to in some way. So the history of Lynchburg, and, you know, again, you know, that's the first story I heard was because of that. But yeah. In reality, you know, who knows why Lynchburg? It's like you think about some of the states, like, if you, like, if I tell you, I went to South Carolina and Georgia, if you travel, you see all of these Indian names for all kinds of Indian names are everywhere. And one could assume that's because Indians were there and the impact the Native Americans had on the area.
Yeah.
But it's hard to know why anything has the name that it has. Like even the raspberry pie. Why would somebody name it that? You know, and pie.
I have no idea.
P-I-E. It's spelled P-I. So for those of you thinking about making a raspberry pie, it's not a raspberry pie. It's a raspberry P-I. So.
Yeah, leave that E off the end when you're Googling.
Absolutely.
Thank you for listening to Eminent Teachnology. If you like the show, please review, subscribe, and recommend us to your friends and family. We'd love to hear feedback from you as well. You can email us at eminentteachnology@gmail.com. See y'all soon.